Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 3 of episode 38, where we are concluding our discussion of John Van Manen's paper, Police Socialization, a longitudinal examination of job attitudes in an urban police department, published in Administrative Science Quarterly on 1975. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is the final part of the episode where we explore the relation of the text to contemporary discussions on research methods and ethics of fieldwork and tie up the conversation. So if you haven't listened to parts 1 and 2, it may be worth doing so beforehand, as this is when we introduced the text and covered some of its implications for contemporary organization and management theory and practice.
There's a number of methodological aspects that this paper has, in addition to the thematic stuff that we've been discussing in the previous two parts, to do with socialization and control and all those sorts of fascinating things. But a thing that is, I think, very important and pertinent now is exactly how Van Manen conducted the study. And we mentioned in part one that he essentially went through the police academy training. He took part in patrols as an armed participant, which is like, what? How can you imagine going into field and carrying a sidearm with you as part of your fieldwork investigation? I mean, Tom might, but unless it's in a, if it's an external organization to your own, that is just, to me, that's unimaginable, really, which is good. But more importantly, this is all characteristic of covert research, essentially, where the researcher does not disclose himself as such to participants. And with Van Manen's study, it's a bit of a gray area in the sense that the police officers knew that he was a researcher, but not the public whom he was interacting with. And since a lot of the stuff that is happening in this paper has to do with police officers and police departments internally, I guess that's kind of okay, but this isn't the only thing that came out of this study. And then there's a paper a couple of years later that deals almost exclusively with interactions with the public. And of course, there, this isn't the case, and the ethical issues are far more sketchy than they are here. But kind of back to the point is, what is the ethical and scientific value of conducting covert research, especially ethnographic covert research, where the researcher is basically lying to his research participants about his identity and purpose and what he or she is doing there? And I have a few things to say about that. And Pedro very helpfully attached a paper by Thomas Roulet, who was a guest on our episode for in season 3 for Carl Weick, who wrote this year, I think, published a paper exactly on this, kind of like the reevaluating the value of covert research. But what do you think of these issues that have to do with this study, and how much is that a function of the time when it was conducted, so the 70s, and what is the relevance and the relationship of this kind of study and this kind of ethical consideration today?
I think that what is interesting here is, well, we think about it, for quite a long time, talking about covert research was almost like a taboo topic, you know, and we might understand that why, because when Van Manen was writing, of course, ethnographic fieldwork was still something that was, you know, trying to claim some legitimacy in the field of management and organization studies. It was, of course, very used and known to anthropology and maybe sociology as well, but for this specific field was, you know, was emerging. So it was hard to tackle such kind of ethical discussions. And now that there is some kind of, you know, greater acceptance of this kind of research, I think it makes much sense to try to think what are not only the ethical problems, but also the very value of disclosing partially the research that is taking place. And I think that's the main argument of Thomas with the other co-authors, that covert is much more complicated than just a dichotomy, you know, and they have this whole kind of, you know, framework that they develop and trying to think of that in more continuum, in more like a continuum, you know. It might, as we're pointed at, Dimitris, you know, in the case of Vamanen, was overt for the police department, but covert for the citizens. And there is also further complications, because in a way one could argue that fieldwork is always covert to an extent, because you are, the research question, the issues that you yourself are interested in may change. So even if you assume that you're trying to get informed consent and explain what really is that you're interested, that very thing might change in itself. You know, so it's hard to completely inform the person what is your research about, because there's not a fixed thing, you know. There's always people that you meet as part of, you know, the work you're doing. The case of Vamanen is very clear. You're going to meet citizens outside of the organization, and that kind of, you know, the indirect data or even direct data you collect from that might be part of your analysis. So it's a much more complicated issue than we have traditionally thought about. And I think this paper is an interesting launchpad to address this.
I think another complication there that we should mention, so that we don't assume that everyone who listens to the podcast is a qualitative researcher, that why we're having these debates is because it's a twofold thing with qualitative research. One has to do with that qualitative research, the researcher is the instrument, and so the data that is generated and the effects that the researcher has by his or her presence on the data are a big thing to consider here. And and second is that the data itself is malleable to so many things that do not apply in quantitative studies, that the stuff ranging from how it is produced and co-produced with the research participants to the to the interpretation of meanings, not least, and meanings, and not even, you know, touching upon things like analysis, but just how to record this information that has been just generated through the interaction that happened just now and only now and will never happen in the same way ever again. So, you know, touching upon the complete irrelevance of replication in a quantitative sense, this brings these debates about covertness or overtness to the fore in a way that would not necessarily apply. Actually, would not apply. I'm going to go and take a stand here to quantitative studies in nearly the same way. And that's why this is important. And that's why this is a big ethical thing. And, you know, there is a number of parties and aspects that need to be considered with regards to whether researcher is transparent to immediate, primary, secondary research participants, and then what to do with the data, what to do with sharing the interpretations with the research participants, should you not, how is that going to impact the final analysis, and so on and so forth. There's just so much there that needs to be considered when doing qualitative work that it's unique to this type of investigation, especially if we're doing ethnography, which is like the extreme of qualitative study.
Yeah, and just on that note, it's exactly, from what I understand, it's one of the reasons why many times ethical review boards or institutional review boards, as they are called in the US, the terminology changed, I think, here in Europe, have sometimes a hard time approving qualitative research, you know, which is detrimental. If we can argue, well, I am an ethnographer, so I'm kind of biased from the start. So I was going to say it is detrimental to the very development of organizational studies and management studies, you know. So this kind of touches upon a number of prickly subjects.
That's a very That is very true. That it's not just an ethical consideration for the researcher. It's also the boards. I happen to currently serve on an institutional review board in the U.S., and it's actually not a topic that we have had to face with any of the cases that we've currently adjudicated, but it's definitely in the back of our minds because, well, we think about research that might happen within, say, a military organization. There's a lot of anxiety. I don't want to say anxiety, but there's a great deal of concern over the ethical conduct of research. There's a lot of attention to it, and I sense from reading the article that some organizations, one in particular is cited, that have taken a very, very hard line approach to say that covert research is not going to be accepted, even though the article touches on a whole wide range of reasons where covert, like in particularly covert participative observation, where it, in order to learn something that's very, very important about society or about the organization, you may have to go underground for whatever reason. And I can think of any number of reasons why, say, in a military organization, you would want to do something like that. I'm not saying that that would necessarily be what I would want to research, but if you're looking, trying to get into discipline issues or disciplinary problems or morale problems or what have you, there's potential to go about it through a covert mean in addition to, say, using a formal investigative tool such as, an inspector general would look at a particular, a case where we're trying to determine whether something was done right or wrong. For a systemic thing, if we have a particular phenomenon that or a crisis that keeps returning, shall we say, then what kind of means do you have available to go try to dig into it and figure out what's going on, what's going wrong? So I can definitely see the author's points as to why covert research may be needed, but I can, as a sitting institutional review board member, I do not look forward to adjudicating one of those cases because I'm thinking, my word, I so many questions would go through my mind. What could possibly go wrong? And that I can imagine that it would be a very, very difficult conversation that the board would have to undertake.
Well, interestingly, so much of some of the coolest stuff has been learned through what we would now consider extremely unethical covert studies. On the one hand, yes, there is big issue to consider with regards to how is this going to affect the participants and the ethical conduct of the investigation with regards to institutional affiliations and conflicts of interests and that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, it does seem to yield some pretty remarkable science, or at least inspiration for some pretty remarkable science. And there's a number of examples where this has happened, and they do range from kind of more to less extreme. For example, something that I pulled up for this episode is, for example, the Labov's study of New York department stores, where it's a sociolinguistic study and has been as influential as it has been problematic. But basically, he went into a number of department stores in New York and talked to people working there to determine whether they adjust their accent to correlate with the social standing of that particular department store where they work. And he didn't tell them why he was there, and he didn't tell them that he's recording it. He just asked something like, where can I find pants or whatever, and they say in the third floor, and then he'd go and record the phonetically how they said it in his notebook while taking the escalator upstairs. And that's fine in not methodologically, but you know, that doesn't affect the participants at all. You know, they're just doing their job. Nothing. There's no impact on their lives through him doing this study. And then on the other scale, you have stuff like what Milgram did in 63 with the study on obedience to authority versus personal conscience, where, you know, people coming out of that work could arguably have been coming out with PTSD from having, in so far as they could tell, murdered a person or at least severely hurt an innocent person. And that is, you know, highly, highly problematic, but it did yield some incredible scientific results as to the nature of human psychology and the response to stuff we're discussing on this podcast, like power and, authority and the responsibility that management has in exercising those. So it's a very complicated issue, and I'm not sure where Van Manen falls on this scale, probably not too far on the Milgram part of it, but I mean, we need to remember that he was conducting the study as an armed participant observer. So, you know, nothing happened, but had something happened during data collection, it would have been a whole different story. So it's important to justify the means and not just in terms of the ends.
Mm. But, well, let's play a bit devil's advocate here, you know, because I think what it's the underlying thing is that there is a separation between the researcher and the person. And, you know, there is another aspect to that is also, what about when the two meet, the two are the same person? Because we could say that John Van Manen was, in a way, practically speaking, a policeman for that situation. So it's almost like he was doing, not really now the ethnography, but he was really participating fully as much as he was observing, you know. So then it becomes also a matter of how much you are allowed to participate in the research context.
You mean like riding in the back of the car as opposed to riding in the front seat?
Yes. Yeah. Well, in his case, it was in the back of the car.
Do you mean like in terms of priority in a situation, what is the priority? Is it acting as a policeman or acting as an ethnographer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like brutally, am I taking down field notes or am I catching the thief or something like that? Is that what you mean?
Well, yes, I mean that in that situation. But I think the problem is that you might have someone that, you know, and that's another case of covert research in which someone just goes and work for an organization and, you know, take notes from that and write a book. You know, you go and you enter and you would act like anyone else in a way. So you are in that space because you are allowed to be there and do the work. But at the same time, you have the, I don't want to say ulterior motive, but you have also your interest in taking that into a learning experience, you know. So that's the other aspect of covert research.
Well, I think the thing there is that, and as with many of these books as well, that even though you are a full participant, you are not there for the same reason as everyone else is. And then coming out of this situation, exiting it and writing up the analysis of your experience, even if it's an autoethnography, the trust that was formed. For instance, let's take Van Manen, right? So he went through the police academy, and mm-hmm. say he would spend more time in the field as an actual police officer, you know, integrating with the squad and doing actual police work. And then he exits that. The bonds that would be formed between him and research participants, you know, that those would be broken in a very unnatural way. And so the people he would be interacting with, it would have an effect on them and their kind of perception of what happened and the value that these hard-forged social, visceral camaraderie bonds that they formed as part of the profession would kind of be devalued or whatever. But that's, I think, one of the effects. It's not just, you know, so no one was hurt. He was doing there the things that he was allowed to do. It's more that the effects that this has on the people that he's interacting with as a research instrument. And that's kind of the sketch a bit, that do you expose yourself as a research instrument and thus potentially, you know, Hawthorne affect the entire study? Or do you potentially cause adverse effects on the relationships that and the kind of psychosocial characteristics that the people you're interacting with, you know, are forming around you? You know, we did, you know, ethnographies, both you and me, Pedro, slightly different extents, but I came away with, you know, a friend from my studies. He knew why I was there and what I was doing, but, you know, had I just pretended outright to be an architect, conceivably the same friendship would have been formed, but then if once I exit and say, hey, actually, I'm this other dude, you know, what effect does that have on that person?
Yeah, I understand. Well, in my case, I didn't do covert research, just to put it out there. You know, it was very overt and the company knew and everyone knew. And I tried to be as overt as I could. I would carry an information sheet. And, you know, when I would go to meetings and meet new people, I would just like hand it so they would know that I was there being a researcher and I was just not another person hanging around a meeting. But I think the other aspect, and Thomas Roulet and the team in that paper that has been recently published in Organizational Research Methods that we're referring to, also talks about not only is that people know about the research in general, but what parts of the research they know about, to what extent do they know about, you know? And I think that was referring to is that sometimes it's not even clear to ourselves what we are interested, you know? So maybe John Van Manen could have started this research and he was interested in, I don't know, maybe socialization. But eventually he could become interested in the way that the policemen treat, I don't know, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, because it's just something that became important to him, you know. So then the question becomes, should they renegotiate the access? Well, it doesn't really make sense. Should you, you know, inform the people about that? It's just something that is, you know, your own private research interest that has changed, but as you know, it's a research. So it is where the other aspect of being covert that comes up.
I say one of the things that that I kind of took away with this too is that well, we're looking at these studies retrospectively. So Van Manen, at the time, of course, he was a pioneer. He was trying to blaze a trail for a new methodological method. And so now let's say that the same type of study is going to be presented now and is going to be designed and put forth for say, a review. One of the things that I really like about Roulet's work here is that in, say, the figure, when we're talking about, and this is on page 12 of the copy that I have, this it's figure one, and it kind of shows sort of how they set up a continuum along two axes about the depth and the breadth of consent. So now if we're Van Manen today, in that sense, what we can do is, you know, this could be a good tool for researchers to critically evaluate their own protocols to say, all right, just how much covert do I actually need? Could Van Manen have built his research differently to make it less covert and still accomplish the same thing? I think armed with these kind of tools, it might help with adding to the ethical nature of the research. So I saw that as particularly valuable.
That assumes you kind of know what you're going after, which is not the case in a lot of ethnographic research. That, you know, you get in there, and often you know, to get one thing and you come out with something else, as Pedro mentioned. And in that sense, kind of restricting yourself along these pre-existing frameworks is not only most likely ineffective, but might just be further misleading to your research participants.
Well, I would agree that I think it's still a very helpful thing. Of course, things are never predictable, but at least make you, while doing the research, you know, think of what kind of challenges and ethical grounds I'm stepping in as I move my theme so radically, or as I join a new department and don't tell them about it, or whatever, you know, we decide to do. So it's just a way maybe to navigate ethically what could be the, you know, to even situate yourself really in this issue.
No, I agree, and I think it's useful. I'm just saying that it's useful in kind of post-facto justification, because, you know, ethics in the field are emergent just as the data is. And it's important to enhance the tool of research, i.e. the researcher, with the ability to navigate and make these decisions as a as an agent in the field, as opposed to, you know, frameworks and checklists and that sort of thing. That, and, you know, that, that comes with a lot of additional training and training in ethics and, dare I say, philosophy even, that, you know, how do you handle yourself as a human being, you know, what in these situations. And now that I'm kind of on this, that, you know, what is the element of humanity and the degree of humanity that you bring to the field as well?
Well, just to react to that, Roulet does talk about, you know, things like situated ethics as an alternative way of thinking about these issues, and also the thing of post-hoc kind of making sense of what is happening. You know, there's different ways you could obtain consent, and one of the ones at least is exactly, you know, as post-observation kind of consent, you know, after you have made sense what is happening, what it was really interested in, what eventually became your research, you know, you can always, well, you could try at least to go back and try to, you know, debrief the participant somehow. And that's what has been done by some, you know, management scholars. So, you know, just to complicate even further.
No, I actually have been in the situation where during part of my study, I formulated a relationship that existed between the primary research participants and the secondary research participants. And in my opinion, it didn't come out to be it didn't come out to much credit to the primary research participants. They basically came out of this looking as extremely oppressive to the secondary research participants. And I didn't know whether I should bring it up at first. Primarily out of fear of them saying that I completely misinterpreted the situation, when I knew I didn't, because, you know, I had I triangulated the data, I had lots of examples and this and that, and I didn't want to lose this analysis on the stage of where it would be misvalidated by research participants, which is, you know, a big thing. If they say that no, you're wrong, you kind of have to act on that. Or at least consider it seriously. And in the end, I went and I said, like, hey, you know, this is what I found. What do you think of that? And they were like, yeah, totally. That's exactly what's going on here. You know, what else is new? And, you know, that was as surprising as it was relieving in as for a researcher. But, you know, of course, there's definitely situations where, you know, what I was afraid of is taking place, and is something that needs to be considered, because, you know, we are also there as, you know, social scientists, and we see things that they might not see, and we see what they do that they might not know that they do.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think table 3, which kind of gives a good guide for the observer, a series of questions to ask or what have you. That's a good useful tool, because, you know, again, sitting as say on an ethics board and looking at a protocol that would come in and try to do something that would have a covert element to it, I would want to have some checklist. I wouldn't want to go down the road of absolutes and say, like, you know, no covert anything. At least this gives us a point of entry to try to understand what the protocol is trying to accomplish, in addition to guiding the researcher, so that we can make sure that the institution is protected, because that's ultimately what the board serves for, is to protect the institution. And we certainly don't want to discourage, you know, we want to encourage cutting edge research in important areas and promote the good name of the institution in kind. And being able to have tools that could allow us use our judgment to, you know, validate what a protocol is trying to accomplish, that I think is a very good thing for everyone. Because again, you don't want to get into a game of just saying no, because that just turns the whole thing bureaucratic, and then it frustrates researchers.
I just want to add bad bureaucratic, because bureaucratic can also be positive.
This is true. This is true. I apologize for that.
I'm the bureaucracy police sometimes, just because it's my research theme. So I think what we are saying here is that, you know, the point is, I think we all would agree that it's important for any research to kind of strive for some goals, like not harming people in any way, you know, not either directly while doing the fieldwork or also after you leave the field, in which you disclose things that might have a series of repercussions, negative repercussions in this case, you know. So the issue, however, is, and I think it's the argument of this paper, and more or less the argument you're making here, is that there are different ways this can be done. You know, you can still use some kind of covert research, but at the same time try to protect the identity of the people, try to interact with them in a way that is not going to be harmful, and so on and so forth, you know. And I think it's pretty much what Joe Manin has done in his own research, you know. Well, at least there was no major ethical issue after he's published his stuff, so I suspect that...
Of course, you know, it's to do with the responsibility of us as researchers towards the research participants, but you were just saying this, I realized something in conjunction to what Tom said with regards to protecting institutions, but it's also about protecting the researcher. You know, Van Manen carried a weapon with him in field work. He didn't need to use it. But imagine if he had, and imagine if he, you know, had to kill someone. What kind of an effect would that have on him as a, you know, an employee of...
He did his speech at Arvine, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a huge... huge consideration to have. Or
no, but it is important, especially because having an external point of view that can see what kind of risks are accompanied in that sort of research context is definitely important.
So for those of you scoffing at qualitative research, we're heroes dealing with complex ethical dilemmas. Respect that. Or at least we ought to be anyway.
Yeah, we are expected to be at least.
It's sad that you know, after qualitative research, you know, has been around for so many years now, and we're still defending it.
Yes, indeed.
But that, you know, that's a topic for a different. For a different episode.
A different episode. Yes. So this has been a very interesting discussion. And I think once again, we have seen how much looking at the classics can be enlightening for a whole variety of issues, empirical, theoretical, methodological. So we have made sense of the work by Van Manen and understanding both within the time it was done and how much it helped to push a number of conversations regarding occupational dynamics, regarding paying attention to work practices as a way to understand organizations, and attention to cultural aspects that he would himself develop in other publications. And also the issue of methods and the whole attention to ethnography and in general fieldwork methods. And we have explored... in terms of themes, how much annotation for socialization is still important today, how much, you know, a push for conformity and have a more, you know, strongly built and enforced culture can be positive in some ways, but can also create a number of negative issues, such as reducing autonomy, reducing the capacity for innovation within organizations. You know, when we also discussed how much socialization might still be very present today, but be happening more at the level of the personal specialization instead of the organizational level. And whereas at the organizational level, what we might have been seeing now is a push, not so much a concern for socialization, given that the careers and have been, well, not really the careers, but the tenure of people in organizations has been reduced. So there's more attention for the hiring, and through hiring, trying to maintain a more kind of homogeneous workforce, so one that has a number of shared values and orientations. And there is also, there has been featured in our discussion, the issue of methodology, and more specifically, the ethical dimension of doing fieldwork research and how much that touches upon of covert and overt research strategies, and how much we can really aspire to be overt, how much of the benefits might be associated to covert research in different ways, that mean being covert regarding the existence of the research or the depth in which people are aware of what you're researching, and all the kind of intricacies that come from. And it seems that we have a general agreement that, you know, there is some value to covert research, such as in part what John Van Manen has done, but also it creates more demands on the researcher himself or herself to be more attentive doing fieldwork and asking oneself what you are doing and what the possible consequences are. So it gets us what are general issues.
Sounds yeah, about
I think,
right.
I think for, yeah, it's, that's an excellent summary. For me, it was really great to go back to the one of the original studies of socialization and of just being able to look at my own organization, which is large and similar to police organizations, how much there is in common, and yet also understand a little bit about the differences and what the differences mean. And it's also it the methodological discussion was also very important because we're coming up at a time where there's so much more scrutiny in all aspects of what we do. And especially as we're trying to conduct research and trying to promote ourselves as an academic community, there's a lot of hard decisions that have to be made. There's a lot of important questions to be studied, to be researched, and the methodological discussion, I think, is an important conversation to have as to what we should not be allowing, and how do we ensure that we provide adequate protections to researchers, participants, and the institutions promoting the research.
And that's all for episode 38. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next week for episode 39 as we read and discuss the paper, A Garbage Can Model of Organizational Choice by Cohen, March, and Olsen, here on Talking About Organizations.